The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. After the attack on the Saudi oil terminal, claimed by Yemeni rebels, now appears that Iran was the key actor here.
The FK facility is the world's largest processing facility. It processes perhaps 7 million barrels of oil per day.
The New York Times publishes false news damning Judge Kavanaugh 1 year after his appointment and confirmation of the Supreme Court.
To rehabilitate really bad allegations that had no support or evidence.
A big win for religious freedom from Arizona's Supreme Court.
If the government could crush Joanne and Brianna, it really could crush anybody.
And no sooner does America declare energy independence, the Democrats want to put us back in bondage to foreign powers.
They want to make us more vulnerable to attacks out of Iran.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my radio program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand 24-7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Saudi Arabia's oil facility in the deep desert is a massive one. From that one facility alone in the desert kingdom come 5.7 million barrels of oil a day. That's 5% of the total world supply. And notably, this production facility is deep in Saudi territory. Yemeni rebels, who claimed responsibility for the drone attack, are more than 500 miles away. After last weekend's attack, attention for responsibility has quickly shifted to Iran and the broader geostrategic issues there. It also highlighted a host of issues regarding energy and our nation's energy independence. Joining me to sort through some of this was Dan Brulette, our nation's Deputy Secretary of Energy. A fusillade of 20 missiles and drones hit Saudi Arabia production. Oil prices spiked 10% this morning. Light crude's down to $61.65 a barrel, so it's beginning to shake off the impact. What is the impact on global energy supplies of what is believed to be the Iranian attack on Saudi Arabia?
Hugh, as you just, as you just pointed out, this is a very sophisticated, it's a brazen attack on one of the world's largest and, frankly, most important parts of the energy infrastructure. The FK facility is the world's largest processing facility. It processes somewhere on the neighborhood of 6.5, perhaps 7 million barrels of oil per day. So very important part of what we do. Surprisingly, though, in some respects, the world's oil market sort of not written off, but has sort of shrugged off this important attack. And that's a sea change in where we were just 10 years ago, perhaps even just 5 years ago. You know, had this happened back in the 70s, we'd be looking at $100 to $150 a barrel per oil. The fact that we're not, I think, shows, one, the oil markets are fundamentally different than they were back then, and two, America is in a fundamentally different place than it was back then. Our production is up. We're going to produce somewhere near 13 million barrels per day in 2019. That's probably a jump to about 13.5 million barrels per day. And because of that, we are able to withstand any of these types of activities around the world.
Now, the president responded by saying we're going to accelerate pipeline construction. We're going to accelerate production of oil wherever we can. What role does the Department of Energy actually have in any of those decisions? It seems to me pipeline decisions are primarily state functions because they control the land use issues.
Well, intrastate, you're absolutely right. But interstate, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, has a role to play, as does the U.S. Department of Transportation. So the president's directed all of the agencies that have a part of this, a piece of this puzzle, if you will, to move expeditiously to move some of these permits through the process. What we've done at Secretary Perry's direction and the president's direction is what we feel are very common sense things.
Well, energy is freedom. It's freedom for everyone. So I'm all for the production of it. Let me raise a second order impact of the Iranian brazenness. If they can mount that sophisticated level of an attack against a Saudi facility, they can also launch drones and cruise missiles against the United Arab Emirates nuclear plants. I don't know if anyone has talked about this yet, but are we looking at the defense of, it's the gold standard. What they have constructed there is the safest nuclear power in the world. But if the Iranians are so reckless as to attack the world energy supply, imagine what they'll do to little Sparta if they can. Have we looked at defending that cluster of plants?
Absolutely. We've had several conversations. The National Security Council met yesterday, as a matter of fact. We discussed a number of issues. Security in the region is paramount. It is important that we make sure that the region remains stable. Iran is a malign actor. They will do anything at any time, so we need to be prepared for that. What the president has asked and what he has directed, however, is for Saudi Arabia to step up to the plate. We want a signal from Saudi Arabia that, you know, they are going to provide for their own defense as well. And once they are willing to do that, then we feel that security in the region will be secure. So we're looking at all of these various options.
150 judges. There are a number of accomplishments we could talk about from the Trump administration, but you'll always find me going back to judges, judges, judges. And the 150 mark was passed just last week. It was widely celebrated as a historic landmark, and it's a lasting transformation of the federal judiciary. But the two highest profile appointments of the bench, of course, were those on the Supreme Court. Justice Neil Gorsuch in 2017 and Justice Brett Kavanaugh in 2018. The Kavanaugh nomination, of course, set off a firestorm, a take-no-prisoners effort by the left to take down a quality nominee at any cost. This past week, the unsubstantiated accusations resurfaced yet again in the pages of the New York Times. Dennis Prager turned to the author of the definitive book on this story, Molly Hemingway. Her book, Justice on Trial. Here's Dennis.
Molly Hemingway, while you were writing that book, did you often feel that you wanted to shower?
It was difficult, actually, to go through the interview process where people kept going through their memories over and over again of what the confirmation process had been like. All of us who watched it on TV thought it was difficult to go through, but when you're having dozens upon dozens of people relive the pain and the excruciating nature of trying to fight against these uncorroborated allegations that the full weight of the media were carrying, it was difficult to hear people. You know, we had a lot of grown men break down and cry when they were talking about it, and, you know, made us promise not to say that they had done so, or otherwise reliving their memories. It was really awful, and that's why what happened this weekend is really awful, and seeing how people are not going to let it go, and they're just going to keep trying to destroy this man.
So let's talk about this still trying issue. A piece of the New York Times, Brett Kavanaugh fit in with the privileged kids she did not, about Deborah Ramirez. I was stunned. I thought she was so discredited in her charges that nobody could corroborate. The last thing the New York Times or any mainstream newspaper would want to do is resurrect her charges. How do you explain this?
Well, this is what the new book that these New York Times reporters put out was designed for, to rehabilitate really bad allegations that had no support or evidence. And they do that by ignoring all of the many refutations of these charges and then allowing people to sort of come up with better memories or claim that they have more corroboration. It is remarkably weak. It is, again, what we predicted when we wrote Justice on Trial. We get into this, how this is an established campaign of the left to not just allow the end of the confirmation process to be the end of their campaign, but they will continue and try to redefine history and rewrite what we all know happened so that they can feel less bad about what they tried to do to this man. They did it with Clarence Thomas. They've done it with other judges. They're now doing it with Kavanaugh. And they will do it again so long as they are not held accountable. You note that Ramirez's allegation was weak. That's a nice way of putting it. She herself was calling around to her friends and saying, I'm not even sure if what I'm thinking about even involved Brett Kavanaugh. And yet that became somehow cause for an extended investigation. She spent 6 days with Democrat attorneys to try to come up with a story involving him that she admitted at the end of that she wasn't even entirely sure of her story. And yet this is the basis of this book. This is the means by which they are using to try to destroy him. And it's, you know, I would like to say it's surprising. It's not surprising at all. And yes, they admitted that they, you know, that they messed up in this piece that they wrote, but their campaign to destroy a guy who probably has one of the best reputations of any man in America, they just are not willing to let it go.
So I don't understand. What are the New York Times reporters claiming? I don't. In light of what you just said, what
They concede that Christine Blasey Ford has no corroboration, but they say we found seven witnesses who will corroborate Ramirez. Now, they actually don't have seven witnesses.
Who claims there were seven witnesses to his exposing himself at this party?
Yeah, the authors claim they have seven witnesses. They have zero witnesses to him doing this. They have seven people who say that they heard about it in one form or another. Their standard for saying one form or another includes literally that Ramirez's mother was told by Ramirez, and I quote, something happened at Yale. Literally something. I mean, that is not corroboration for a for something such as this. It was...
So yeah. Nobody, there was literally no one who claims they saw it happen.
Zero witnesses.
Zero.
They claim... Yes,
they heard that it happened. Who is this guy, Max Steyer, and what is he saying?
So Max Steyer is another classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's. He is a former Clinton attorney. He was pitted against Brett Kavanaugh during the Whitewater proceedings. So Brett Kavanaugh worked for Ken Starr in the Whitewater investigation. Max Steyer defended Bill Clinton. They go way back. They have a history. And the allegation, the supposedly new allegation that the New York Times reported isn't new. This was actually made last year. He told, apparently, two Senate offices, and they thought it was so ridiculous. They didn't even bother passing it on to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And when you think about what met the standard of being passed on to the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, we go through it in the book, that included such things as that Brett Kavanaugh had chartered a rape boat in Rhode Island and had engaged in a nationwide crime spree with a buddy. Those things were taken seriously enough to pass on to the Senate Judiciary Committee, even though they were patently absurd, but this didn't rise to that level. This claim from allegedly from Max Steyer is that he saw a group of people manhandle both Brett Kavanaugh and a woman. The book quietly concedes that the woman who's alleged to have been a victim denies any knowledge of this. They didn't put that in their article in the New York Times that went viral. They forgot to mention that their supposed new allegation also was denied by the alleged victim. They left that out, and they added a correction very late last night.
Coming up, the backward-looking energy approach from Democratic presidential candidate.
They want to make us more subject, more vulnerable to attacks like this out of Iran, linked to the Houthi rebels in Saudi Arabia.
Colorado Senator Cory Gardner in the next segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I pointed out just a bit earlier the key accomplishment of this administration on the judiciary, passing the 150 judge mark, nominated and confirmed. One reason this transformation is so important is because the courts are the key forum for the fight for the future of our freedom. This is one reason we're so proud to be partnering with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. They are, simply put, doing yeoman's work in defense of our first freedom. Their attorney, Jonathan Scruggs, joined Seth Liebson to talk about a key win this week in the state of Arizona. From AM 960, The Patriot.
You want to give a brief overview to the audience about what was gained of importance today? I think a lot.
As you know, Brush and Dip Studio is an art studio. It was started by two young women, Joanna Duca and Brianna Kosky. And when they were starting the art studio, they looked around and said, hey, you know, we hear about these people getting sued all across the country. What's the deal with that? And they found out that Phoenix has one of these laws. It was actually a really severe law. It threatened artists with up to 6 months in jail and $2,500 in fines if they don't comply. And what the law effectively did was would force them to create art celebrating same-sex wedding ceremonies, mm-hmm. which was against their faith. Mm-hmm. And they basically said, hey, we can't do that, so we need to go to court to protect ourselves. They did that, and the Arizona Supreme Court ruled in their favor and said no, that the city of Phoenix cannot force artists to convey messages they disagree with. So this is an enormous victory for people of faith and for speakers all across Arizona and really all across the country.
You made an important argument about, and it's a subtle one that I want more people to understand, which is it's not that they were in any sense targeting or discriminating against anyone of the LGBTQ identity. It's that they didn't think that they should have to violate their own religious freedom to serve them. They would happily serve people in that community, just not something that would violate and celebrate their faith through their own artwork.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It is a key distinction that Joanna Brianna, they serve all people, including the LGBT community. They're happy to create home decor pieces, you know, all these different topics. But they're a few messages that they cannot convey in their art for anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't create artwork celebrating racism, mm-hmm. No matter who asked,
right.
or artwork, you know, kind of exploiting the female. They can't do that for anyone. Well, it's the same thing about the topic of marriage. And that's why this ruling is so important, because it transcends this particular topic,
right.
and protects speakers of all views. Because if the government could crush Joanna and Brianna with jail time and fines, it really could crush anybody.
And I can testify, by the way, to the fact that they're not going around asking these questions in the first place. I hired them. They don't know me individually, but I hired them to after I learned about their case, because I liked what they were, you know, I liked their gumption, and I liked the idea that these two young women started a small business. You know, I just liked the whole idea of it, using their God-given talents and nurtured talents. So I hired them to make me some thank you cards. They didn't ask me any questions, but it wasn't obviously anything that would violate their faith. Seth Leibson, whoever he is, he wants a thank you card. Fine, we'll make them. We'll give them designs. They do it. They're not putting anyone through some kind of Salem trial here.
And that's absolutely not, because it's about what goes in their art. It's not about who walks in the door. And that is a key distinction. That, you know, every speaker across the country exercises these freedoms,
right.
you know, whether it be Google or Apple. They're constantly declining to convey messages they disagree with.
Absolutely.
Well, what should distinguish these artists, these two Christian artists who can't convey a message that they disagree with? It was a resounding win for freedom of speech and freedom of religion.
These First Amendment free expression wins are absolutely victories we need to celebrate, but there's no doubt. Continued dogged diligence on the legal front is what we need in order to guard those things we hold dear. And continued dogged diligence is what we need if we want to retain the ground we've gained in energy independence in the Trump era. I turn to a key senator from a key energy state, Cory Gardner, a sharp voice representing Colorado.
I saw light crude is up $10 this morning, 10% actually, 10% this morning. That's kind of good news for some oil producers in Colorado, but it's bad news for the world.
Well, you know, why I think this is all bad news is this. You have heard now a dozen presidential candidates stand up on the national stage. We have the state legislature in Colorado, the Democratic leadership in Colorado, all say they want to end production of oil in the United States. They want to end fossil fuels in the United States. What they want to do, and this attack just shows it, is make the United States so subject and so vulnerable to attacks on Middle East energy production facilities that it would destroy the U.S. economy. Imagine what would have happened had their attacks on oil and gas wiped out our energy revolution in the United States. Imagine what this Saudi attack would have done to our economy.
Now talk to me a little bit, Senator, about what you think are the best options on the table. If, in fact, Secretary Pompeo gets more information, persuades everyone, what do we do?
Well, again, we have to go to Europe and present this evidence and say, come on, Europe, stop just, you know, playing footsie with Iran here. You've got to realize this is a bad actor, a bad regime that wants to bring down the global economy. And so that's the first place to start. Secondly, we have to ramp up our efforts so there continue to be a number of avenues we can pursue on new sanctions, more sanctions to make it more and more difficult for the mullahs in Iran to profit off of their illicit activities and their global economic activities. We have a state legislature that just passed the Colorado version of a Green New Deal that would ultimately lead to, and already has led to, bankruptcies, slowdowns, and layoffs in oil and gas. You've got a natural gas export facility in northwestern United States that still awaits pipeline authorities. That would help our allies in Asia to no longer be dependent on other regimes, oils, or natural gas sources. They want to make us more subject to more vulnerable to attacks like this out of Iran, linked to the Houthi rebels in Saudi Arabia. 50% of Saudi Arabia's production shut down. The impact felt globally. You just said a $10 increase a barrel, and that's the future the Democrats want for us, is to make us even more dependent and ban that fuel production here in the United States.
Talk to us a little bit, Cory Gardner, about the race that you're in for the Senate. I put your website up, CoryGardnerForSenate.com. I know you need small donors, you need support across, but you need support across the West, but also across the United States. What is it looking like? Because the Democrats have got like 20 people in their primary.
Well, they do. In fact, there's another one who just joined today in the primary. So, you know, there's nearly a baker's dozen in this race. I think it's a race to the left. They all support a Medicare for all or a public option, which would destroy thousands of jobs, increase the cost of care. Recent reports have shown how devastating that alone would be to Colorado. They all support versions of the Green New Deal, part of which just destroyed Colorado's energy industry and has caused moratoriums to take place across Colorado. They want to reverse the tax cuts that have grown this economy and have resulted in more money coming back to the United States. Their idea is simply economic pain for the people of this country.
Now, we also have in Colorado an effort to subvert the Constitution with the Electoral College. Where do your opponents stack up on that? They're trying to basically disenfranchise Colorado voters from the Electoral College.
Well, they all support it. I mean, look, if you listen to their words, they want to give our electoral votes to California and New York. It's ridiculous. A state like Colorado, we should vote who Coloradans vote for. That's what the Electoral College was designed to do, to give states that aren't the population size of Texas or New York or California its own voice instead of just being a flyover in a presidential. You know, the sponsors of this bill to remove Colorado's electoral votes said that Colorado doesn't matter. Well, you know what? I believe Colorado always matters, and we should do everything we can to enlarge our voice, not lessen it.
Coming up, after the assassination of Lincoln, after the Civil War,
what then do you do with the newly freed slaves, and how are they going to be integrated into this reconstructed Union?
Reconstruction, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. It was April 14, 1865, when John Wilkes Booth pulled the trigger on the gun that delivered a fatal shot to Abraham Lincoln. And so ended the life of perhaps the greatest president the nation has ever known. By the time of Lincoln's death, the Union victory in the Civil War was a fait accompli. The question and the next challenge was, how do we put this war-torn nation back together again? The task of reconstruction after the assassination went to the new president, Andrew Johnson. One of the best historians on this period is Alan Gelzo. He joined Dennis Prager.
Do you folks know what happened after slavery was abolished? We had something called Reconstruction. Had it worked, America would have been a better place. It didn't. Why it didn't is the subject. The man who gives this course is Alan Gelzo, the professor of American history, director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions at Princeton. Sadly, Americans know very little of their history. Tell us, in a nutshell, what Reconstruction means.
Reconstruction is supposed to mean re-knitting and reunifying the divided Union at the end of the Civil War. We fought a civil war, for 4 years between the authority of the United States and the breakaway Southern Confederacy. And Reconstruction was supposed to put the pieces of the nation back together again. Now, that's putting it in the nutshell, there are so many working parts within that nutshell, though, because complicating simply the act of reunifying the country, you also have to deal with the fact that the Civil War ended up abolishing slavery. What then do you do with the newly freed slaves, and how are they going to be integrated into this reconstructed Union? So there are a lot of complications that enter into reconstructing the Union, and it's not something that is easy to do because there's no real easy template. There's no reconstruction for dummies that you can go out and buy in 1865 at the end of the Civil War and easily work up a template for doing it. A lot of it was improvisation. A lot of mistakes were made. And truth be told, we are living with the
country. That's right. What would have happened if Abraham Lincoln had not been assassinated?
Dennis, I'm asked that question probably more than any other question. One of the basic answers I have to give is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because Lincoln was a man who played his political cards very, very close to his chest. People said about Lincoln that he was the most shut-mouthed, reticent man they had ever met. And he did not take people into his confidence, and he did not put his policies out there for people to take shots at. On the other hand, Lincoln also was a man of great political flexibility. He would attempt a particular initiative. If it didn't work, he would bounce off that. He would try to move around it and go in another direction. If Lincoln had lived, certainly one thing he would have saw that would have been non-negotiable would have been the full participation of the freed slaves in the political life of a reunited nation, which would have made all the difference in the world. That would have been a priority for him. And in his very last speech, that was one of the things that he was calling for. Now, if that had happened, if real political integration had happened, then we would have had a very different end to Reconstruction. Likewise, if we'd also had, along with that, more economic integration, so that the freed slaves suddenly find themselves at the end of the Civil War, not only free, but able to become productive and move into the mainstream of the American economy. The change in American racial relations would have been so dramatic that we would not recognize all that has happened in the last 80, 90, 100 years. It would have made that much difference. Well, that didn't happen. And in large measure, it was because it was fought, first of all, by people in the South who turned out not to be interested in those things, mostly white people. And also, it was fought by Northern Democrats who had no desire to see a free market economy take hold in the South. And between the opposition that is generated by Northern Democrats and the opposition that is generated by what you can only really call terrorist resistance, put those two together, and what you get by 1877 is an overthrow of what were otherwise regimes of hope in the southern states. And that not only sends us in the direction of Jim Crow and segregation and white supremacy, it also sends the South into 80 years of economic stagnation in which the South really doesn't participate in a meaningful way in the ongoing industrial and commercial development of the rest of the country. It's a tragedy.
Catch the rest of the conversation and a link to Gelzo's video for PragerU at townhallreview.com. Coming up, call sign chaos.
So we were on the ground, and we were joined as fast as we got there by Allied troops. They were with us immediately. I'd go out at night and say, why are you here? You weren't attacked by these maniacs on 9/11. They said, because we share the same values.
General James Mattis, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, Tora Bora, Anbar Province, Fallujah, and the Sunni Triangle. These battle zones were familiar to Americans over a decade ago, but are now fading from our collective memory. They and others are vividly revisited in a recent book by former Secretary of Defense, Marine Corps General James N. Mattis. In his new book, Call Sign Chaos, Learning to Lead, General Mattis covers four decades of his life as a Marine Corps combat officer. The general recently joined me in an admiring full house at the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California. Here are excerpts of that interview, which we later broadcast on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
You were the first to command a Navy ship. How much static did your admiral get for that?
Well, he wasn't a man to worry about what other people thought of him. But there were seven ships at times. There was a Canadian ship, HMCS Halifax, would be the destroyer that came in as we went near the coast each night, and the six U.S. Navy ships.
You mentioned the lesson you learned because your Marines were not allowed to go and trap Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora. You faulted yourself for not communicating up. Would you explain that?
Yeah, so we were on the ground, and we were joined as fast as we got there by Allied troops, mostly from NATO. They were with us immediately. I'd go out and they'd say, why are you here? You weren't attacked by these maniacs on 9/11. They said, because we share the same values. Very interesting lesson on leadership about the United States and how much people trusted us that they would come and fight alongside us, knowing by doing so they were going to attract the hatred of the terrorists who had attacked us. Something to remember when we think about NATO. We took Kandahar Airport. We took over the town, basically, and the Afghan people were overjoyed to see us. But Osama bin Laden, our intelligent people, had spotted, or at least had very good indications, that he was in one of two valleys in a place called Tora Bora. I had a computerized visibility diagram done. We picked out the mountaintops. I'm all focused on this. I know how we can block the routes out, and then we're going to move assault troops up the valleys and flush him out. He wouldn't be able to stay there. What I'd failed to do, and the lesson I learned, Hugh, was I'd fallen under Army command and control at that point. I still commanded the ships at sea under the Navy, but the troops ashore after a little while were put under Army command and control. And I had not spent time getting to know their general and explain to him what I was putting together. I assumed too much. And so basically we didn't get the orders to go, and Osama bin Laden got away.
There's another inexplicable halt on the march up to Baghdad.
Yeah.
And you describe it in detail. Would you tell the audience what that was and why it was so frustrating to you?
The attack into Iraq in 2003 was one where we assumed the enemy had chemical weapons, and we weren't the only ones who assumed that. The United Nations assumed it, the Israelis assumed it, the Kuwaitis assumed it. There were a whole lot of intel communities that thought that he had those weapons. Why else would he be blocking the UN inspectors? So when we attacked, we were zipped up into chemical protection suits. They're very uncomfortable to fight in. They're difficult to move in. You sweat a lot in them. It's just tough. And we were stopped at this point as we were tacking up a road that is on the direct downwind from Baghdad. In other words, we'd been told as we get close to the Tigris River approaches that we would be hit by chemicals. There was a concern with supply lines. We did not have concerns in the Marines. Every Marine is trained as a rifleman. So if the supply troops, we would bypass some enemy if they weren't a big problem with our assault troops. And if the supply troops had to fight their way by them, that was their problem. They knew how to fight. I wasn't worried about it. This wasn't exactly a tough enemy. So we did not want to stop, because when you stop, the enemy can start getting brave and feeling like they can stop us. So it was very frustrating. I was within probably 24 hours of designating the 5th Regimental Combat Team into the 5th Reconnaissance Combat Team and going on a very strong reconnaissance for the Tigris River at that point. Again, I think what we have to watch out for is, in the age of electronics and digital communications, it's easy to think that up above you know what's going on. Down below, the young sergeants and lieutenants, they knew we could keep going. There was no problem. The logistics troops back in there, they knew they could fight their way by the enemy. But somehow people got nervous up above and stopped us at the worst possible moment. And eventually we got going again, but the enemy had had time to adjust, so it was more difficult than it otherwise would have been.
But a lot of people did write that the delay at Tora Bora and the delay in the march up was because Big Army did not want the Marines to accomplish those missions, that there was inter-service rivalry impacting the chain of command. Do you credit those allegations at all?
Not in the least. I think there were very straightforward reasons why it happened, and I think that is just a bunch of baloney.
What happened in the first Battle of Fallujah?
We went into Anbar province. It was the most difficult area in terms of the embedded insurgency. We were relieving the 82nd Airborne Division. They'd briefed us very well about what was coming up. There was a very good turnover, but within a couple weeks, four contractors wandered into Fallujah without checking in with the Marines in the area. They were killed, burned, bodies strung up, desecrated. And we knew that the city had tribal elements. We had spies in the city. And so what I suggested was, don't get angry. Great nations don't get angry. I'll get the bodies back and get them back to their loved ones, and we'll hunt down. We've got the photos, and we've got people who tell us who did it. We'll hunt them down, and we'll kill them. Out of Washington came orders, despite what my senior, Lieutenant General Conway, wanted to do, which was support me with this much more measured, targeted approach. We were told for other reasons we had to make a demonstration. And so we had to evacuate hundreds of thousands of people. Of course, that meant the enemy could be in amongst them, moving stuff in and out and that sort of thing. And I only had two assault battalions to throw against the city. So it was going to be a heck of a fight because there were more enemy in the city than we had troops to put against it initially. And I said, okay, after 4 days when they ordered me to do it, I'll do it, but don't stop me. And, of course, deep inside the city again, we were stopped, eventually pulled to withdraw. But what was really important, I remember a young light machine gunner. He's a kid from down south, blonde-haired kid, filthy, dirty, with his machine gun over his shoulder as the Marines were pulling back and a camera got put in his face. And he has asked, isn't this terrible? You know, it's terrible you lost your buddies. Isn't it terrible you have to pull back? Don't you feel terrible? And the young kid doesn't talk real fast. Just turns around, looks in the camera and says, doesn't matter. We'll hunt him down somewhere else and kill him.
To hear the complete Hewitt Mattis interview, go to townhallreview.com. I guarantee you will enjoy. He's one of our nation's treasures. Coming up.
Between about puberty and 25, there's really the kind of final scaffold for the brain is being determined. Drugs of abuse are really able to produce lasting effects.
Drug abuse and youthful mind. In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, more on the New York Times smear of Justice Kavanaugh.
Pretty much nothing that was reported in the Times was accurate.
The key witness? Not much of a witness after all.
The woman who is claimed to have been the victim in this case has no memory of it.
There is a deepening concern about Joe Biden.
I think there's something wrong with him. I think he is having a medical issue of some sort.
And we'll look at a gruesome discovery on the property of a former abortionist.
What kind of an evil, fallen, disgusting fetish could this be?
We've got this and more, all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. A short while ago, the president announced he was instituting a ban on the sale of flavored e-cigarettes. This followed news of disease and death linked to these products impacting America's youth. My colleagues Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson, morning hosts at AM 560 The Answer in Chicago, recently interviewed author and neuroscientist Judith Grissel. Dr. Grissel is a researcher on the effects of substance addiction on brain development in young people.
What's been your reaction to this outbreak of respiratory illnesses associated with vaping an illegal product?
Yeah, I wasn't aware that it had been narrowed down to THC. So my understanding was that there was a derivative of vitamin E, actually, that may be toxic in some cases. I think
Yes. We
really don't understand it very well. We do know that tar in tobacco is really the most damaging component. So I have been thinking, along with most people, that vaping was preferable. But we don't have enough data on it, and I hate for the data to be ascertained from patients who are dying. So it would be important, I think, to actually learn about what are the compounds in vaping and how are they incorporated and metabolized in the lungs. And I think right now we don't know. It's true that nicotine is highly, highly addictive. And if anything, the nicotine contained in vaping will be more addictive because
you can get more, even more quickly than you can with smoking.
How do drug and alcohol abuse affect the brains of young people?
The brain is so plastic. Anything we do is changing our brain. Listening to the radio or going for a bike ride or watching TV, our brain is always very responsive. It's kind of different from other organs in that way. But drugs are such potent stimuli. They're really stronger than normal stimuli, you might say. And for that reason, they have really potent effects on the brain's structure and function. Now, those effects are going to be even higher during periods where the brain is changing, and that includes adolescence for sure. So between about puberty and 25, there's really the kind of final scaffold, I guess, for the brain is being determined. And during that period, drugs of abuse are really able to produce lasting effects. So it is a particularly vulnerable time.
Speaking of the vulnerable time, what is your disposition towards the education that is being provided associated with the move for legalization of marijuana around the country?
I do think that we have shown over the last 50 years that laws are not great ways to control people's behavior. And I don't think that better or stronger laws or more powerful punishments are going to affect this growing epidemic, really, of addiction. But on the other hand, I think that maybe educating people about how the brain changes and what the consequences are and how, you know, it really is, addiction is the third leading cause of death in the world that's preventable.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on our earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producers Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.